recorded for our blind and print-impaired listeners. The North Carolina Reading Service brings you this week's edition of Indie Week. Broadcast this week is dated October 28th of 2020 and is read by John Federson. And our alert listeners this week may have detected a difference in our theme music. And in fact, we had so many positive responses to our Arctic Penguin Ensemble a few weeks ago, we thought we'd give the old music hall act Wanda and Her Cockatoos an opportunity to resurrect their career by performing today. Thank you very much. Good job. And as they flap on over to our cuttlefish buffet, let's get it going with Indie Week. We will start this issue right with the hard news. And this first column from Durham, written by Rebecca Torrance, is titled Ballot Boss. Every election day, Derek Bowens wakes up and plays the most motivational song he can think of, CNN's Election Night in America theme. It provides an early morning jolt that gets the Durham County Elections Director ready for the busy day ahead. The booming drums, violin swells, and electric guitar riffs follow Bowens as he springs out of bed, brushes his teeth, and heads to the office just before 5 a.m. If there's one thing that riles him up, it's the rhythm of democracy. "It's so great," he said of the song. "It gets me moving." Not that Bowens needs help to get going. 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, he manages precinct officials and elections administrators, oversees voter registrations and absentee ballot mailings, supervises 14 early voting sites, and prepares for the most important day of his year. On November 3rd, how well he handles these details could have a significant effect on the confidence in, and maybe the outcome of, the biggest election of his lifetime. He loves his work because it matters. "I see it as the bedrock of our democracy," he said. "That importance should be met with a level of intensity." Bowens sweats the details. He knows election law inside and out, and his employees joke about how easily he catches the errors they've missed. He says, laughing, "I had one staff say, 'I don't want to call Derek over to solve this, because the minute he comes over, he'll find the problem instantly.'" He's relatively new to Durham, having arrived from New Hanover County, North Carolina, in 2016, and his colleagues say the office is more efficient under his leadership. According to Philip Lehman, chairman of the Durham Board of Elections, there were 792 mistakes of varying degrees in the 2016 election, the primaries, which took place before Bowens arrived. In this year's primary, there were 8. Lehman said, "Derek is running a multi-ring circus, but he's always ahead of the game." As director of elections in New Hanover, home to Wilmington, Bowens became known for his well-organized warehouses where necessities, from ballot machines to "I voted" stickers, are kept. But don't look for signs of organization on his desk. Papers are scattered across the cherry wood. Calendars, timesheets, flyers, and reusable paper towels. He wanted to see if they could be used to sanitize polling places. "They say organized people have the messiest desks," he deadpanned. Colleagues say he never loses his cool. When a problem arises, he goes into solutions mode, turning his eyes to the sky. His employees know that when he lowers his eyes, he'll have a plan. The former director, Samuel Gedman, deputy director of elections, says there was never a moment when he seemed panicked or overwhelmed. He simply lays out what needs to be done. "In this business, that's huge. We feel confident that things are under control." Growing up in Wilmington, Bowens lived in an apartment in the projects with his single mother, sister, and 2 brothers. His mother, who worked at a preschool, tried to expose her children to positive experiences while shielding them from drugs and violence. Eventually, she married Bowens' stepfather, who was the owner of a local painting company, and built the family a house in the suburbs when Bowens was 12 years old. But the years of poverty had made their mark. Bowens wanted to keep climbing up. He was a good student in high school, a self-described nerd. He was president of the debate team and won a Principal's Choice Award, accomplishments that helped him earn grants to subsidize his college education, which he split between UNC Charlotte Community College and UNC Wilmington. The 2008 presidential election was a turning point in his self-realization when he saw a black man on the ballot for the first time. In a necessarily nonpartisan job, Bowens doesn't talk politics. Still, Barack Obama's candidacy and subsequent presidency rocked Bowens to his core. He said it was something that I could never fathom. It was the first time I felt like I could do something in this country. After graduating, he got a job as New Hanover County Elections Specialist and quickly ascended the ranks. By February 2015, at age 27, he was the county's Director of Elections. Now 32, Bowens is significantly younger than many of his employees, but Deputy Director of Elections Brenda Baker says he has an old soul. He could be any age, she said. He's very mature, a methodical thinker, and a great problem solver. Bowens says any worries about a chaotic election are unfounded. I have every confidence in our ability to execute a great election here in Durham, he said. At the mention of voter intimidation, Bowens' jaw clenched. We're doing everything we can to create a safe voting environment in Durham, he said. The issue of voter intimidation is very important, and it certainly won't be tolerated. In addition to the unarmed security guards, if a precinct in Durham does see an instance of voter intimidation, Bowens said, I'll be the first one out there, I can tell you that. During Baker's interview for her role, her first impression of Bowens was of, quote, a pretty serious and very precise person. At first, she worried he would be a tough boss. But after 5 p.m., when the phones finally stop ringing, his employees see him at his most comfortable. He takes off his shoes and wanders the office in his socks. He whistles to himself and blasts Michael Jackson's Greatest Hits from his phone. Bowens says unwinding together helps build camaraderie. He doesn't see his own family much these days. He says his wife, Andrea, doesn't always agree with his commitment to the job, but she understands the importance of it, he said. He misses his 3-year-old daughter, Harper, most of all. But this is our democracy, he said. It requires sacrifice. Now we have 2 long articles. This first one by Jonathan Michaels, War on Torture. At the urging of anti-torture advocates, North Carolina Democratic Congressman David Price is requesting that the CIA disclose information regarding the state's outsized role in the rendition, detention, and interrogation, that's RDI, program implemented in the wake of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Between 2001 and 2005, the CIA supervised the kidnapping and rendition, or transport, of suspected terrorists to secret prisons throughout the world. Detainees were often held without charge and subjected to so-called enhanced interrogation techniques such as waterboarding, slapping, sleep deprivation, sometimes for as long as 180 hours, as detailed in the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence Torture Report. Those techniques are now widely recognized as torture. The clandestine operations were among the most brutal aspects of the Bush administration's war on terror, yet few official details have been made public about the rendition flights, and no American officials have been held accountable. Price, who represents North Carolina's 4th Congressional District, which covers most of Raleigh, Cary, Chapel Hill, and Hillsborough, sent a letter to CIA Director Gina Haspel on October 5, requesting specific details about the individuals who were transported overseas, along with information regarding Aero Contractors Limited, a suspected CIA front company specializing in, quote, discreet airlift. Aero is based at the Johnston County Airport in Smithfield, North Carolina, just 30 minutes southeast of Raleigh. Aero pilots are believed to have conducted the majority of U.S. renditions before 2004, transporting an estimated 48 men and 1 woman, all of them Muslim, into the hands of American and foreign offices for interrogation, according to the North Carolina Commission of Inquiry on Torture. The information requested by Price includes the number of people rendered in total to foreign custody, the number of people rendered aboard aircraft based in North Carolina, the fate of those prisoners during the RDI program, and details about their current whereabouts. The letter also targets Aero for increased scrutiny in order to obtain a complete list of rendition missions flown by the aviation company, a list of missions flown by Aero for the purpose of servicing CIA black sites, including those not transporting prisoners, a clearer understanding of whether Aero continues to forcibly transport detainees either within or without the United States, and whether other private North Carolina companies are participating as well. Price explained in an email to Indy, "I hope to receive clear, thorough answers from CIA Director Haspel. The program needs more transparency and a better accounting of who has been involved and what taxpayer-funded infrastructure was utilized." If Haspel complies with Price's request for information, it would provide the American public with its clearest picture yet of the role of rendition within the RDI program, along with the full scope of North Carolina's involvement in the torture of detainees. It would also fill in crucial details about CIA-backed renditions of detainees to foreign countries like Egypt and Morocco for interrogation by proxy. Christina Cowger, an anti-torture activist with North Carolina's Stop Torture Now, says, "This represents the first time that a U.S. congressperson armed with as much information as this citizen inquiry could generate is demanding the CIA come clean about aspects of the rendition and torture program that have never really been scrutinized by any official body." The North Carolina Stop Torture Now grassroots coalition formed in 2005 after a New York Times expose revealed Aero's role as, quote, "a major domestic hub of the CIA agency's secret air service." Any information gleaned as a result of the letter to Haspel would have to be seen in part as a victory for North Carolina citizens who have spent the last 15 years fighting to focus attention onto Aero's so-called ghost pilots. Cowgirl says, "What the letter represents is real progress. Finally, citizen activity has prompted a congressional request for information, but also it reveals how much is yet unknown about how the CIA conducted this massive kidnap and gulag program, and how it used foreign proxies to shuffle prisoners in and out of those countries into black sites." Knowing that Haspel herself is implicated in the very types of activities the letter seeks to expose, it seems unlikely she will consent to Price's request. Before President Trump tapped her to lead the CIA, Haspel supervised a black site in Thailand known as Cat's Eye during the early years of the War on Terror, according to reports by ProPublica. Haspel is believed to have personally overseen the interrogation of Abd al-Rashim al-Nashiri following his suspected rendition on an Aerojet, tail number N379P, in 2002. Interrogators dressed in black repeatedly slammed Nashiri against a wall, confined him to a small coffin-like box, and subjected him to waterboarding, a technique that simulates the experience of drowning, according to ProPublica. It reported in 2018 that he had lasting scars from the interrogation in Thailand, including a phobia of water, anxiety, depression, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Later, Haspel reportedly played a role in destroying 92 interrogation videotapes recorded during her tenure at the Thai detention site. The suspected cover-up touched off a U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence investigation that resulted in a damning 6,700-page torture report laying bare the lurid details of the CIA's enhanced interrogation program. Regardless of Haspel's response, Cowger views Price's letter as a hopeful step. She says, "We will publicize the letter. We will use the letter to approach Governor Cooper, Attorney General Stein, and other Democrats and Republicans who have the power to also step forward and say this is a problem." Price's letter draws heavily on the work of the North Carolina Commission of Inquiry on Torture, a citizen-led, non-governmental body spearheaded by Cowger and other anti-torture activists. pulling from hours of witness testimony as well as meticulous records from amateur plane spotters and troves of publicly available documents, the commission produced an exhaustive report aiming to fill in details about extraordinary rendition that were notably absent from the U.S. Senate investigation. The report described a typical rendition flight wherein Aero pilots departed from North Carolina to pick up a rendition team at Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. before heading to the destination country. There, the abduction team allegedly snatched detainees and then shackled them, stripped them naked, and loaded them onto an Aero-operated plane, which one survivor likened to, quote, a torture chamber in the sky. The NC Commission estimated that Aero conducted an astounding 80% of the identified CIA renditions between 2001 and 4, which, as I previously reported for Shadow Proof, distinguished North Carolina as a major facilitator of extraordinary rendition, because the flights would not have been possible without state and local funding, infrastructure, and other resources. The commission noted even after Aero's role in the CIA program had come to light, local and state authorities continued to lease space to the company, provide public airport services and facilities for rendition flights, and provide grants to fortify the company's perimeter at its airport headquarters. President Obama terminated the RDI program in 2009, but Aero continues to operate out of Johnston County. Kauger says, so Aero could still be rendering people. They could be engaged in human rights abuses today. Attempts to contact Aero for comment were unsuccessful. The email addresses provided on the company's website were invalid, and there is no listed phone number. There's little chance of knowing what Aero's activities are, past or present, without federal or state officials opening an official investigation. Many of them have refused to do so, regardless of their political allegiances. Corporate records filed with the North Carolina Secretary of State's office show that in September of 2019, Aero changed its legal name to Triangle Aviation Solutions Corporation. The business was originally incorporated in Delaware and started operating in North Carolina in 1979, according to the files. Members of the NC Stop Torture Now made regular appearances before Johnston County Board of Commissioners and appealed to every governor going back to Mike Easley, who left office in 2009. The group has yet to receive any official response. Governor Cooper also declined to look into Aero when he served as the state's attorney general, citing a lack of jurisdiction. The governor's office didn't respond to requests for comments from the Indy. Laura Brewer, a spokesperson for current Attorney General Stein, also a Democrat, wrote in an email, quote, our office is reviewing the materials that the NC Commission provided to us. The lack of access to information is not only a hindrance for activists like Cowgirl, looking to raise public awareness about NC's role in CIA rendition, it makes it more difficult for elected officials who might be sympathetic to their cause to investigate the issue as well, said Tommy Ross, a senior associate at DC think tank Center for Strategic and International Studies. From 2005 to 2009, Ross served as Representative Price's legislative director. In an interview conducted earlier this year, Ross recalled how difficult it was to get any information about the classified RDI program on behalf of concerned constituents back in North Carolina. He said, Representative Price was always sympathetic to their concerns, we just didn't know a lot. Even if state officials had been asking questions and trying to get information, as surely some of them were, it would have been nearly impossible for them to get anything real. Ironically, the North Carolina official best positioned to shed light on the secretive program is also probably the least likely to do so. As chairman of the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Senator Richard Burr is tasked with overseeing the activities of the CIA and to demand accountability. The Republican senator, however, has repeatedly signaled his disinterest in dredging up any more details about the secretive program which occurred under a Republican administration. In fact, Burr began clawing back copies of the Senate's full, unredacted torture report from various governmental offices in 2017, the Washington Post reported, in order to shield them from requests under the Freedom of Information Act. That's why anti-torture activists in North Carolina have traditionally focused more of their energy engaging with Democratic officials who may be more susceptible to pressure. The results have been mixed. Koger says, Democrats who have been willing to make this an issue and keep making it an issue are extremely few. On the federal level, Price remains an outlier among NC officials who have been willing to touch the issue. He attended a film screening last year of The Report, a fictionalized account of the tumultuous investigation into the CIA torture program, in which he commended the work of the North Carolina Commission and announced that he had entered its report into the official congressional record. Within state government, anti-torture activists found allies in the late North Carolina Representative Paul Libke, who represented Durham for 25 years, and Representative Verla Insko, whose district covers much of Chapel Hill and Carrboro. Just last year, Insko filed a state bill called Ending NC's Involvement in Torture, which would have granted the state attorney general special authority to investigate Arrow as recommended in an NC commission's report. Although the bill failed, Insko told the Indy during the Democratic primary earlier this year she would be open to submitting future legislation to raise awareness about the issue. And she said, most legislators are not educated on the role in rendition. If Democrats win the majority back, we will ask someone if they can set up a task force and look at it in a study bill that would help educate legislators. Another problem is that seemingly negative issues like torture and covert CIA operations are unlikely to win over voters, particularly during an election year coinciding with a deadly pandemic that has claimed the lives of nearly 4,200 North Carolinians. Insko said, this is not an immediately pressing issue like health care or education. You don't have to educate people on that. They're living it. They know it. Still, other North Carolina Democrats may be taking the cue from President Barack Obama, who insisted that Americans look forward, not back, on the issue of torture. Obama said glibly in 2014, we tortured some folks. I think it's important when we look back to recall how afraid people were when the Twin Towers fell. It's important for us not to feel too sanctimonious in retrospect about the tough job those folks had. Kaugel worries that elected officials fail to see any political upside in taking on the issues, only risks. She hopes that Price's request for information will inspire Cooper, Stein, and other elected officials to take a similar stand. She says Price's letter just might help to show people that it's possible. And if in November there's a change of power in at least one house in the North Carolina General Assembly, then we're hopeful there can be legislative action. Ross, Price's former legislative aide, believes that a cultural shift is just as necessary as a political one. Ross grew up in Greensboro, the site of the 1979 Greensboro massacre that left five anti-racist activists dead. He compared the challenges confronting anti-torture advocates to that of the Greensboro Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which formed after years of fruitlessly agitating for accountability from city officials. And Ross said, we have a moral responsibility to wrestle with the implications of our actions, even if they were taken in good faith, or even if they were taken in ignorance of information that might have made us think differently about them. This month, more than 40 years after the Greensboro massacre, the city council issued its first formal apology. Cowgirl and her colleagues hope they won't have to wait that long for recognition of this more recent ugly chapter of the state's history. Reflecting on NC Stop Torture Now's 15-year struggle to demand accountability for the state's role in the CIA torture program, Kaugor lamented how protracted the campaign has been. Rendering justice for torture survivors is one of the primary motivations behind the group's years-long campaign to bring the issue to light. Next year, four torture survivors, next summer, four torture survivors will finally have the opportunity to present their grievances before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. Three of the men, Binyam Mohammed, Abu El-Qasim Brital, and Bishr al-Rawi, were rendered to foreign proxies for interrogation aboard a Gulfstream V aircraft, presumably operated by Aero, according to the NC Commission. Meanwhile, at least 13 other people who were transported by Aero are still believed to be languishing in captivity at the U.S. detention camp in Guantanamo Bay. The longer officials obfuscate, Kauger warned, the longer justice will be denied. It's not plausible that officials can't do anything, she says. It's a matter of political will. Our next article by Julio Gutierrez, Ivory Coffers. The University of North Carolina system is in crisis. Hammered by the pandemic, its flagship school, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, announced layoffs for student employees last month as it faces a projected $300 million loss. Various faculty and staff members have been cut as well. The COVID-19 fallout is hitting the entire UNC system, with North Carolina State and East Carolina University bearing the brunt of it alongside Chapel Hill. And yet, the UNC system holds more than $6.5 billion in its endowment fund. In June, a collective of graduate workers petitioned UNC Chapel Hill administration, demanding all remote instruction, no layoffs or furloughs, and funding for all graduate workers. To finance such a plan, the petition called for redistribution of the school's endowment. University leaders, who often regard the endowment as untouchable, dismissed the petition, which highlighted the need to examine such a massive financial resource and its opaque administration. As an economist and PhD student at UNC Chapel Hill, intrigued by the black box of public higher education finance, I decided to dig more into the history, functioning, and inequalities of the University System's Endowment Fund. This is what I found. The fund. In finance, an endowment fund pools money from various sources and allocates it across a diverse set of investments. Nonprofit institutions such as public universities and charitable organizations use this as a way to meet some of their main expenses. University of North Carolina system has utilized this type of revenue-generating mechanism for decades. The UNC system schools created organizations for the sole purpose of collecting money and investing. These usually take the form of foundations and investment funds, which are registered as nonprofit corporations in the North Carolina Secretary of State's office. While each university has its own set of organizations, in the past two decades, these have been pooled together into a single fund known as UNC Investment Fund, or UNCIF. Of this giant pool of assets, UNC Chapel Hill holds the largest share with $3.6 billion, followed by NC State's $1.07 billion fund, according to the school's 2019 annual reports. The most recent annual report issued by the UNC management company reveals information about the UNCIF's performance and holdings. According to the report, the market value of the fund has increased by 60% in the past 5 years, adding nearly $2 billion worth of assets. It also reveals the types of investments in which UNC has been involved, including stocks, bonds, private equity, real estate, and energy and natural resources. The history of the UNCIF is a long and complex story about bureaucratic restructuring and the corporatization of the UNC system. The first steps began with the creation of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Institutional Development Foundation, incorporated in 1976. Among the main objectives of this institution was, quote, to solicit, acquire, receive, hold, invest, reinvest, sell, transfer, and administer and manage property of all kinds, unquote, for the benefit of the university. This business-oriented strategy was reinforced in the 1990s, first with the creation of the UNCCH Foundation Investment Fund, we call it CHIF, and then with the recruitment of Notre Dame's Senior Investment Director, Mark Yusko, as the fund's Chief Investment Officer. In 2002, Yusko pursued two major tasks. The first was that creation of the UNC Investment Fund, UNCIF, to pool together the assets from the entire UNC system. By that time, only a few universities had investment funds, amongst them Chapel Hill, created in 1995, North Carolina State in 1997. In 2002, UNC Charlotte and UNC Wilmington created theirs. Today, the UNCIF has a total of 31 members, comprising the investment funds of most UNC system universities, as well as other affiliated institutions such as hospitals and foundations. The second task Yusko pursued during his period as chief officer was the creation of the UNC Management Company, an institution whose main objective would be to provide investment management services for the entire system in a centralized and coordinated way. In a conversation with the Daily Tar Heel in 2015, Yusko mentioned that one of the system's main reasons for creating such an entity was to separate the running of the endowment from university administrators. Since then, the UNC Investment Fund has operated like any other corporation, adhering to the principles of what in the business world is known as modern portfolio theory. Yusko and other top officials didn't respond to my requests for comment. But the project of corporatization wasn't an isolated policy. It was pursued to compensate for austerity measures that had been imposed by state and federal governments since the 1980s. This model, which persists, consists of reducing wealth and corporate taxes to incentivize economic activity. For public institutions, however, this has meant substantial budget reductions in state appropriations and an incentive to search for alternative sources of income. To compensate for such cuts, universities have engaged in different business strategies like the creation of investment funds and the transformation of individual schools and departments into non-profit corporations. The UNCIF is controlled by the Board of Directors of the UNC Chapel Hill Foundation Investment Fund. As shown in the 2019 annual report, this board is composed almost exclusively of white male executives from various corporate groups, including biopharmaceutical company Corium, the New York-based hedge funds Coatue Management and BlackRock, and the multinational investment banking group Goldman Sachs. While these directors don't receive compensation for their service on the board, they make important decisions regarding UNC's asset allocation. They also constitute a direct link between the university and highly questionable corporations. Hedge fund managers like BlackRock, for example, have been severely criticized for their overwhelming investments in firearms, fossil fuels, and more recently, a 930-mile train in the Yucatan Peninsula, the construction of which threatens to devastate rainforests located in Mayan indigenous territory. Along with the CHIF's board of directors, the UNCIF is administered by the UNC Management Company, a nonprofit corporation comprising a team of highly trained investment managers. These managers are some of the highest paid individuals in the UNC system. Based on tax records, in 2017, the president of the company earned more than $1,300,000 in compensation. More than $700,000 of this amount was paid as bonus and incentive. These numbers don't include retirement and non-taxable benefits, which push the total compensation to more than $1,750,000. Compensation for other employees of the UNC Management Company for that same year ranged from roughly $351,000 to almost $760,000. Several of them surpassed the earnings of the UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor at the time, Carol Folt. The massive salaries of investment managers are consistent with the company's good financial standing. A graph constructed using the company's tax record shows a sustained growth in net assets since its creation in the early 2000s. The latest filing on the IRS website, which corresponds to the year 2017, reveals this company held more than $17.8 million in assets at the time and ended the year with almost $2.4 million in net income. While UNCIF is subject to internal controls and public reports, little is known about how the UNC management company administers its resources and how it has been able to accumulate such assets. Despite the evident profitability of UNC's corporate models, the disparities that remain through the system are striking. At UNC Chapel Hill, which is the university with the highest endowment, the percentage of instructional staff classified as non-tenure track is approximately 45%, with almost half of them working full-time. Meanwhile, the yearly stipend for graduate and teaching assistants remains at a meager $16,000 per year. These numbers are even more striking when you consider that the university has more than 1,000 employees who earn $200,000 or more. Many of those employees occupy administrative positions in non-instructional departments like athletics or university communications. Major inequalities are also visible across campuses. Financial records show a vast difference in income when it comes to investments. Of particular relevance is the racial dimension of these gaps, as the table shows significant disparities between those universities at the top and historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, within the system. If combined, the total made by the five HCBUs, which are Elizabeth City State, Fayetteville State, NCA&T, NC Central, and Winston-Salem State, the total amounts to just over $16 million. That's for five institutions. That's $2 million less than UNC Greensboro alone, and just a small fraction of UNC Chapel Hill's investment income, even though the total HCBU population is larger than that of both. Unless there are major redistribution mechanisms, these numbers suggest that corporatization merely reinforces economic and racial disparities within the UNC system. Since early in the COVID crisis, there have been calls for wealthy universities across the country to use their endowment resources to protect students and workers. These calls have either been dismissed or categorized as non-viable. As a recent Wall Street Journal article argues, the reason colleges won't use their endowments right now is because funds came from donations designated for specific projects. But this is only partly true. While some donations contain legal restrictions, this is mainly the case for massive gifts made by foundations and wealthy individuals. It isn't the case for the thousands of individual contributions made by alumni, and it's especially not true for investment gains, the distribution of which has more to do with joint decisions made by a fund's board of directors and university leaders. The claim that university endowments are untouchable contradicts the fact that colleges like the University of Delaware and Northwestern University are already drawing on their endowments. Claims about underperformance are also questionable, given that several university endowments, especially those tied to private equity and hedge funds, have been shown to be doing well, a phenomenon most likely related to the Federal Reserve backing Wall Street during the pandemic. On September 14th, UNC Chapel Hill announced that the university could face a budget shortfall of $300 million. The strategies planned by the UNC Board of Governors to face this deficit are ones we have known for decades: layoffs, furloughs, program shutdowns. While these announcements are usually framed as unavoidable costs of the crisis, the data I showed shows that there are alternatives to the university's undermining of its own workforce and human capital. There's nothing preventing UNC from liquidating its fossil fuel assets in order to avoid layoffs, for example. Whatever our thoughts on meritocracy, there is no reason to believe that $700,000 bonuses for investment managers at the expense of housekeepers, adjuncts, and graduate workers are somehow acceptable. I hope that, once presented with the realities of the UNC system's endowment, university workers, students, alumni, and community members will demand answers about the financial structures supporting these institutions. At the very least, we must push forward a much-needed debate about endowment redistribution and a future for the UNC system that benefits all of us, not just a powerful few. This week's op-ed column by Diane Davis, who works as a family medicine physician assistant in Durham. Unaffordable care. I've spent more than 20 years working in community medicine. In that time, I've served many patients who do not have insurance, not by choice, through no fault of their own, but because with low-wage job, they cannot afford traditional health insurance. The financial and emotional strain it puts on parents and families is enormous and draining. The Affordable Care Act has been a huge help. It's the one meaningful step we've taken to expand access to health insurance in decades. Now it is in danger because Donald Trump is committed to destroying it in the middle of the worst public health crisis in a century. For North Carolina, eliminating ACA means ripping away protections for almost 5 million people across our state who are living with a pre-existing condition. It means that more than 1.8 million seniors who save thousands of dollars on prescription drugs will pay much higher, potentially unaffordable prices for the medications they need. And it means leaving behind the 1 million people across North Carolina who don't have insurance at all. Not only is Donald Trump trying to destroy it, he's doing it in the midst of a global pandemic, a time when families are scared not only of the virus, but of the possibility that someone in their household will lose their job and their health insurance along with it. That Trump isn't capable of understanding how much worse the pandemic would be without the ACA shows that he isn't fit to lead us through this crisis. Moreover, for a candidate seeking re-election to have no plan to ensure that Americans can afford to see a doctor is beyond a failure. It's disqualifying. We've waited for more than 5 years for Donald Trump to propose a health care plan, and he still hasn't done it. A few things are clear. He has no plan, he never will, and North Carolinians are done waiting. Fortunately for us, there is a candidate in this race who has a real plan, not just to mitigate the spread of the virus, but to make sure every North Carolinian has the peace of mind of being able to see a doctor when they need to. Joe Biden has told us exactly what he'll do as president. He'll build on the Affordable Care Act by creating a public option that'll give every American access to quality health insurance, no matter their income, zip code, or race. Our country is in crisis, and we have to recognize that we're in this together. Our response has to empower and include every American, and to do that, we need every American to step up and do their part. Every vote counts. Before early voting ends this week, tell your friends, neighbors, and co-workers to make a plan to cast their ballot. Ask people if they have voted, and if they say no, ask when they plan to. Together, we can encourage the turnout that North Carolina needs and help elect Joe Biden. Now, needless to say, if I didn't mention it before, this is filed as an op-ed column. Well, we have a food and drink column, and it specializes in drinks, specifically the Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission. House rules. On November 14, 2019, an alcohol law enforcement agent seized a few bottles of liquor from Mystic Farm and Distillery during a compliance check. It was the second time that month an agent had shown up, according to Mystic's owner, Jonathan Blitz. The first time, nothing happened, but on this visit, when the agent, who had brought along a college intern, reached the kitchen, he pointed to a bottle of Southern Star whiskey, which Blitz was using as a reference sample, and said it wasn't allowed. the problem. Nowhere in the rules did it say that. The ABC's power are granted by the North Carolina legislature, for which just a few minutes, excuse me, which just a few months before had passed a law allowing distillers to sell bottles and mixed drinks directly from their facilities, a freedom breweries and wineries have enjoyed for some time. But even before this, distillers frequently had samples of others' products on site to use as taste references. Blitz believed he was being penalized for an unwritten policy the ALE had no authority to enforce, so he fought back. But instead of dropping the case, the ABC Commission sued him and the very same day pushed out a new set of rules prohibiting unauthorized spirits. The problem? The ABC Commission doesn't have the power to write its own laws. Blitz filed his own lawsuit against the commission, and in response, the courts issued an indefinite stay against the agency on August 31st, prohibiting them from enforcing the policy. A representative from the ABC Commission declined to comment, saying it would be inappropriate, as they have yet to receive the formal injunction. And ABC spokesman Jeff Strickland told the Indy via email, "Furthermore, the ABC Commission is working continuously with interested parties, both industry and the public, to produce rules and guidelines to clarify North Carolina's alcohol laws." Since 2018, the Commission has cited 4 permit holders for, quote, unauthorized spirit. The first among them was Pittsburgh's Fair Game Beverage Company. Owner Lyle Estill has a globe-shaped bar in his office, within which were about a dozen dusty bottles of vermouth. At some point, Estill had considered creating his own vermouth. He bought an array of products to sample before nixing the idea. He says that an exploratory process is critical, and everyone does it in some form or another. "It's impossible to run a distillery without being able to sample other people's products," Estill told the Indy. According to the law, distillers must have a mixed beverage permit in order to sell other people's liquor. However, in both these cases, nothing was being sold, and the bottles seized were reference samples. Blitz says, "As a craft distiller, I find it shocking that the commission found nothing better to do during an economic collapse than to issue and try and enforce illegal rules against our struggling industry. It's one thing to be completely out of touch with people desperately trying to save their businesses and keeping their staff employed. But for the commission to break the law in the process shows there really is a crisis of leadership in an agency that regulates more than $2 billion in commerce in our state." This is far from the first time the ABC system has been the focus of criticism, including revelations from a 2018 audit that the agency had wasted nearly $14 million in taxpayer funds due to mismanagement. North Carolina is just one of 17 alcohol control states left in the county, in the country, and some legislatures think the ABC system should be abolished in favor of a privatized one. But because the current system provides protections for distillers that a completely free market system would not, permittees don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater and would prefer to work with a regulatory agency on reforms. For Blitz, that starts with expanding the 3-person commission to include representatives from the industries they regulate. Beyond that, Blitz wants the agency to stop acting like a meter maid who's making up the rules as they go. He says, "My goal is simply to reset the relationship and have the agency follow the law and have respect for us." And here comes a music column article by Nick Williams titled "Taking It in Stride." In a world without crowded dance floors, running is electronic music's new nirvana. He writes, "I'm barely halfway around the loop and dismayingly close to giving up. It's my first run in weeks, and I'm determined to complete the roughly 4.5 kilometers of Durham's Al Buller Cross Country Trail, but it's not going well. I'm barely breaking a 10-minute mile, and I'm acutely aware of my atrophied leg muscles, my upcoming 40th birthday, and my impending doom. The 95-degree heat is not helping. My Salvation is Musical via iTunes Shuffle, which decides to drop the digital needle on Motormouth, a devilish slice of heavy Detroit techno by Audion, the dance floor-oriented alias of Matthew Deer. It's a wild beast of a track, surging forward on a meaty kick drum, engine-revving synths, and a chattering circular vocal sample of heavily filtered gibberish. It's the auditory equivalent of speedy MDMA, awash in red lights and fog and sweat, and somehow it's an appropriate soundtrack for a dusty, miserable run through the woods. I feel a spring in my step, a burst of wicked energy. By the time Motormouth reaches its drop and the snares start slapping, I'm blasting up hills and pumping my fist. As a 40-year-old father of two young kids, this is as close as I come to the strobe-lit rave days of my youth. Running helps me maintain a deep physical connection to the electronic music that I love, the same pulsating energy that once fueled peak-time dance marathons now carries me over the next hill, through the next mile, toward the next goal. The physicality of dance music is an indomitable force, even if its other vital aspect, the joyous social communion of dancing, is currently in major trouble. Age and parenthood had already, mostly, cut me off from nightlife before COVID-19, but the pandemic has effectively ended clubbing for everyone else. Experiencing any kind of live music with a crowd is now a dangerous proposition, and throwing down with a crush of sweaty bodies is totally out of the question. The dance floor is closed, and the party, for the foreseeable future, is in Chirosleep. Man, I was going to be able to work with so many amazing artists this year, laments electronic artist Sean Garrett. So much was on the books, and it really seemed like 2020 was going to be this huge launchpad of a year, but then COVID happened. It has been devastating. Garrett is one of the heads behind Durham techno label and party crew Maison Fauna. He's also an avid runner and doesn't lace up his sneakers without an electronic mix queued up. When I run, the music just kind of takes over, he says, of his love of lo-fi housed artists like Baltra and Earth Boys. I find it makes me more aware and more in touch with my surroundings. There may not be a social outlet for electronic artists, but electronic music production has exploded under lockdown. Garrett says Maison Fauna has had to pivot away from throwing ragers in favor of the more quotidian duties of managing a label and staying on the lookout for new artists to lift up. And Garrett says of Maison's workload, we have calls every day, we have meetings a couple days a week, and since COVID, I've honestly been consuming so much more music just because I've had time to run and listen. Allison Martlew, musician, said the pandemic created a lot of space to work on music without all the usual distractions, and it's been great for my exercise routine. You might know Allison Martlew from the legendary punk outfit The Butchies, as a member of Amy Ray's band, and more recently from the scathing glitch noise duo Sister Brother, who melted my brain at Moogfest in 2018. Years of grueling tours inspired Martlew to get in top physical condition. These days, she's an accomplished marathon runner. She has run three marathons to the soundtrack of Australian dance music shapeshifters, The Presets. She says, for long runs, I like a tempo that maintains the pace that I'm trying to maintain. They tend to fit into that zone. I've listened to their songs so much. Maybe it's the magic of hyper-familiarity that I can use to even out my energetic and mental dynamics over the course of a few hours. They are my favorite running partner. On Martlew's recommendation, I fired up The Presets' 2005 album Beams on a recently rain-soaked jog. I found it fit exquisitely into the liminal space between invigorating and meditative. That word, meditative, was a touchstone in my conversations with runners, musicians, and musician runners. After all, for all its pleasures, running is an activity that can engender tremendous physical pain. Everyone I spoke with told me that music played some role in mediating or transmuting the discomfort that comes with major exertion. A consummate DJ set can keep a club churning long past the point where everyone should be in bed. The right music can push runners beyond their physical limitations. Andy Stack, the multi-instrumentalist behind Joyero and one half of Why Oak, says he finds the world more beautiful with a soundtrack. He says music draws my attention from the exertion and makes time pass more swiftly. And I'm sure there's a physiological connection with breathing and heart rate and pacing. He adds that he would rather run in combat boots than run without music. If my phone or my headphones go out mid-run, it's twice as hard to keep moving, he says. Corby Hill, writer and music journalist who also fronts the Pittsboro band Land Is, echoes this sentiment. Running without music is fine, but it's not as meditative. The sensation of moving forward, the sensation of exertion in your muscles, breathing in and out, those are the meditative sensations, and the music is the focus of the meditation. His ancient screenless iPod shuffle is loaded with all sorts of genres, but he most often runs to the beat of DJ Shadow, Portishead, and More Chiba. He was part of his high school cross-country team, but found a renewed passion for running, and running fast, after he was diagnosed with a chronic form of leukemia. It was like, I'm going down fighting, Hill says of his diagnosis. I'm going to do everything possible to improve my chances and just be in the best shape possible as a means to an end. Alrighty, our own Indie Week sprint must end now. And even the return of Wanda and her cockatoos can only bring us closer to the finish line. Now, this program is available all week as a podcast on our website, thencreadingservice.org. And for the aforementioned service, I am John Feddersen, bidding you so long from Indie Week.